More than 15,000 scientists are sounding an alarm about climate change.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
A UN panel has issued a dire warning this morning.
A dire warning. Now to a dire warning about climate change.
Cars and homes were washed away.
If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon.
So, we've finally gotten around to talking about climate change, but how are we talking about it in America, and how does that compare with the discussions taking place in other countries? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to meet the KU journalism professor conducting the first research to tackle the global question of how journalists frame climate change coverage, not from one news outlet to another, from one country, one continent to another, because it's a political issue here, sometimes even a debate. But is that the case anywhere else? Let's find out. Hong Vu with us from KU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What exactly have you been studying and why?
So in my study, I look at how the media frame climate change, the news media frame climate change in 45 different countries and territories. And what I wanted to do was to look at climate change with a more global perspective, because we think about climate change, it's a phenomenon that is going to affect every country in the world, and no one single country can say that we are going to be immune from this natural phenomenon. So that's why we wanted to study how climate change is portrayed in the news
worldwide. It is hard to believe that that hasn't been done before. It is such an obviously global problem.
Well, yes. There were studies being done before on media attention to climate change, but by the time we started, there wasn't any study that looked at how climate change was framed in the news.
So because, when you say framed, what do you mean?
We want to look at how climate change is portrayed in connection with other issues like economic, energy, domestic politics, international relations, natural impact, and scientific evidence.
What were your findings? What were some of the big picture findings that came out of this?
So overall, the most prominent frames that we found was international relations. And we also use other variables, macro variables that related to a nation like GDP per capita, GDP growth, and also carbon dependency and climate severity as well, to predict how the media frame climate change. And what we found was that economic development is a deciding factor in how climate change is framed in the media.
So how is a more developed nation likely to portray or frame climate change as opposed to a less developed nation?
So wealthier countries, or the media from wealthier countries, tend to portray climate change in relation to domestic politics and also scientific evidence, why in poorer countries, climate change is portrayed as an issue of international relations and natural disasters. So that's what we found.
How did you go about selecting the countries whose news coverage you are going to look into? Because although the research is global, 45 countries is a lot, you could not explore every single nation that exists.
We look at first the one of the selection criteria that we want to look at countries with different level of developments and different kind of climates as well. We also look at countries with a certain number of language that we can use while studying the media, because we want to use the official language of a country. So we look at four different languages, including English, French, Portuguese, and Spanish. So, and also accessibility is another important criteria on when we select those countries, because not every country in the world have good archiving systems. So we ended up with 45 countries. We wanted to do more, but actually we ended up with only 45.
You know, I mean, 45 is a lot, but I mean, I am curious what it looked like really specifically when you say that the coverage in wealthier nations had to do more with domestic policy, domestic politics, and that in less wealthy nations it had to do more with problems of international relations and environmental disaster.
Okay, so in wealthier countries, climate change has been portrayed as an issue of debate, right? We are still talking about whether or not we should deal with climate change, how we should deal with climate change, and what kind of policy that we should have in order to fight climate change, or whether we actually fight climate change at all. So that is an issue in terms of like the fact that climate change has been politicized in more developed countries, showing that we are not really settled in terms of whether or not climate change exists or how we are going to fight, how we are going to fight it.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense because, I mean, as I think about that, a lot of the industry that gets exported to less wealthy nations, the actual making of things and then sort of the immediate effects of pollution, but also the proximity to the equator, which is where the first impacts are detectable. Am I right about that?
Well, you are absolutely right. And I think that in poorer countries, what we see is that they don't really portray climate change in the sense of domestic politics because, for example, where I come from, Vietnam, climate change is a fact. Nobody would question whether climate change exists. So
why not? Can you explain that?
Because we agree with scientists in general, and according to previous studies, about 97% of scientists, climate scientists, agree that climate change exists, that human cause climate change. So based on that, I didn't do any study on that, but based on my review of the literature, it's pretty obvious that we need to do something about that climate change because it's going to affect everybody.
Something I think we wrestle with in public media is whether to treat something as a debate and one with political overtones because a segment of the population currently views it that way, or whether we need to treat the science of it as authoritative and just go from there, because that's what any kind of evidence, fact-based style of journalism would do with any other subject. But we tend to go with the latter. The question that sometimes haunts me being, can we really just flat out ignore that there are folks who genuinely don't believe that climate change is real? Because if you don't address their skepticism, do they just tune out? And that seems to be the trap journalists get caught up in.
I absolutely agree. And I think that the balanced norm is important for journalism practice in general. But at the same time, when we talk about climate change as a public affair issue, right? If you portray climate change as though it's not, as though the scientists have not agreed with one another about the existence of this phenomenon, we are presenting the issues to the public that it's a matter of debate, right? We are not settled on it yet. So the public would understand that it's a controversial issue and would not take action regarding climate change. So it's the kind of trap that journalists usually falls into. But at the same time, I think that with only 3% of scientists disagree with the overwhelming agreement that climate change actually exists, we sometimes need to go beyond the balanced norm.
Yeah. I want to bring in another voice. John Upton is with us from Climate Central, which does take a distinctly scientific approach. In fact, their website specifically states, as one of the group's tenets, no advocacy. John is the center's liaison with journalists, and he joins us now from Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, John.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Is the concern I just raised one you hear a lot from journalists?
This is around how do you frame the political debate in a story about climate change? Is that what you mean?
The concern about if you treat it as an established fact and don't address the issue of people among your listeners or readers or what have you, that there are members of our communities who don't see it that way. If you don't address their skepticism, do they just tune out? Do you hear this concern when you talk about just presenting it scientifically?
Sure. I've done a lot of reporting all around this country and now also worked with a lot of local newspapers to help them produce climate change coverage. And what I would point out, actually, is that the concept of global warming or climate change is much less politicized than we think. Surveys tell us that we tend to overestimate the number of people who don't believe in this. But the words climate change have been very heavily politicized. I would actually, I often suggest to journalists working in conservative areas that they avoid using that term until later in the story, because a lot of people now have been kind of trained to hear those words and think of political debates. So I think that what you can do in your stories is you can very simply state accurately, you know, fossil fuel pollution is accumulating in the atmosphere, that's trapping heat and that's driving whatever the effect is that you're talking about, whether we're talking about heavier rainfall, whether we're talking about more intense droughts, wildfires, heat waves, storms. It's very possible to draw the connection between what's happening physically in terms of our influence on the climate and then how the climate is responding to that. And kind of strip the story of this really evocative and politically loaded word, which is climate change.
You know, we heard about that's kind of the approach taken by other countries, that it's just not a political issue at all and therefore isn't framed that way. And I want to draw attention to something from the Climate Central website, which I think is an example maybe of what you're talking about. So here's one of the lead stories right now. It starts with a headline: Arctic sea ice near a record low. The date for that publication is September 18th, 2019. And then there's a subheading: Arctic sea ice will soon reach its minimum extent for 2019, 18th year in a row below average. So as I look at the word choice there, the temptation, if political debate were to inform this, would be to fixate on the conclusion you might draw from this being that this is the 18th year in a row that the ice in the Arctic is decreasing. And I notice you don't even use the word melting. There's just less ice.
So what you're reading there is the materials that we've shared with TV meteorologists and journalists to help them incorporate this into their own local coverage, their own weathercast, their own stories. And yes, you know, as a country get better at covering climate change, you know, there's now a very strong appetite, particularly among local news outlets, newsrooms. A lot of audiences are really wanting more coverage of climate change. And as we start, as the media corps starts to really respond to this, and we are seeing them respond to it, there's a lot of collaborations going on. There's a lot of local stories now that are trying to tackle climate change through different techniques, theories, incorporating it into beats, environment beats. But, you know, as we get better together, I think that we're going to need to continue to be really careful about our language and how we frame climate change, because we can't just always go around saying climate change, we have to stop this, we have to do that. We can have much more nuanced and thoughtful and interesting conversations that help really flesh out the issues, the changes we're seeing around us, the opportunities that we have to kind of arrest those changes, to respond to those changes, to slow them down, adapt to them. You know, that's much more interesting, I think, for a lot of audiences than simply talking about whether or not people believe in this concept that's been kind of scientifically demonstrated now for generations.
We'll get right back to this discussion. If you have questions or insights into how American journalists cover climate change, how that's changing, and how it compares to the rest of the world, call 816-235-2888. We've got experts here to take your calls. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and the talk for today is climate change in the news. Our conversation is inspired by the research coming out of KU looking at media coverage of climate change from an international perspective. The professor doing that research has found that there's a discrepancy between how wealthy nations tend to frame it and how poorer countries see the issue. Hong Vu, can you just give a quick recap of your findings for those who just tuned in?
So what we found was that climate change has been framed differently across the countries that we studied. And overwhelmingly, climate change is portrayed in connection with international relations. But at the same time, what we found was that the economic level of different the economic development level would be a deciding factor in how the news media frame climate change, with wealthier countries tending to portray climate change as an issue of domestic politics and scientific evidence, while poorer countries would portray climate change in connection with international relations and natural disasters.
You can call in with your questions, but you have to do it now because we've got just a little time left. 816-235-2888. Our other guest is John Upton. He's with us from Climate Central, which compiles scientific data without advocacy or commentary. John runs the center's journalism partnerships. Hi again, John.
Hey there.
So our access to media is actually international, thanks to the internet, and I could just as easily consume another country's news on climate change, assuming that I can get access to it in English. So that is where the limits kind of come from. But most of us do go ahead and consume our own national media on global issues without thinking to read what they're writing from places, perhaps even places more directly impacted. In the case of climate change, that would be places closer to the equator. John Upton, talk to me about that a little bit, our choices as news consumers.
Well, first of all, I just want to point out that actually the really strong impacts we're seeing from warming are occurring close to the poles, where we're seeing the loss of ice is having this kind of feedback effect that it's causing this tremendous warming, a lot of melting. So it's not so much just that it's tropical areas that are being affected. But yes, we have a lot of potential every day to make decisions about the news we consume. If we were eating McDonald's every day, we'd start getting sick, and the doctor would say you shouldn't eat junk food. But, a lot of us now, well, particularly in recent years, have started getting a lot of our news from Facebook and social media, which is really, there's a lot of junk in there, a lot of misinformation. It's kind of toxic, it's depressing, it's inaccurate. So a lot of our decisions about the news that we consume now are being driven by social media. And, of course, we can decide to consume news from another country, but why would you want to read about Brexit or, prime ministerial elections in Australia if you can read about what's happening in the White House right now? So we will always have a bias towards reading our own news. But what we really push very hard at Climate Central, basically all of our resources go into supporting local journalism. This is reaching people where they live. These are the newsrooms that have typically no science reporter. They have very little production capacity anymore. They're really struggling. So to get them working on climate change, which could be quite scary for them, they might be fearful of the blowback, they might not know how to do it right. I would just say a lot of when we think about what news we should be consuming, let's think about supporting local newspapers, local radio stations, supporting them with memberships, with subscriptions, but also in terms of supporting groups like Climate Central and others that are going out and actually specifically working with local media to help them get better at covering climate change and some other critical issues that we face, because it seems that the big national papers are pretty much doing okay now, you know. We've got a strong national media core. What we see in this country is a tremendous weakness at the local level, and I'd like to see more people paying attention to that.
How would you say that local media outlets should be covering climate change, and what are the challenges there?
It's definitely tricky when you haven't done it before. Anybody who's been in a bad relationship knows if you've gone a long time without addressing an important topic, it can be very difficult to get over that hurdle. So we do training. We send out emails to journalists and TV meteorologists with new data, graphics, reporting suggestions. And what we're always emphasizing is the need to incorporate climate change into your normal news story. So yes, you might have a story on, climate change projections, say that flooding is going to be this much worse in this year or whatever. But when you're doing a local story on farming, the farmers are struggling because the weather conditions have been difficult. Have a think about, is climate change contributing to that? If you're covering a local city hall race and, some of the candidates are talking about climate change and some are not, then maybe flesh out that conversation, because climate change, it's different everywhere. Everywhere experiences climate change differently. And that's one of the other reasons why national news doesn't work so well for climate change coverage. If you're having a conversation in your local community about how the changing climatic conditions will affect your community, affect your economy. If you're incorporating this kind of climate change conversation into everything else that you do, then you're going to be having much more robust and interesting conversations about climate change than if you're just writing a story about a new study and, you know, putting these very dire predictions in your lead instead of thinking and looking around and being a bit more thoughtful about talking to people in your community about how they're being affected directly.
Hong, can you talk to me about how you see this aspect of it in other countries in their news media? Do you see that stories from one part of a country to another, for example, explore every local issue through this lens, or is that not something that you're seeing elsewhere either?
So in my study, I didn't really look at the local aspect of climate change coverage. But in general, what I've seen over the years observing and studying how the news media portray climate change in general in different countries is that we have a problem with climate change being portrayed as an issue that belongs to somebody else, right? It's a global issue, it's a national issue, and less so of a local issue. And what John just said was absolutely right. Because proximity is an important value for news in general, people would be more interested if they find in the news that a story about someone in the community. So in general, in other countries, what we have seen also is that climate change has been portrayed in a very far distance to people, to the member of local communities. And I would also strongly advocate for portraying climate change or reporting on climate change at local level so that people will find the issues more relatable to them.
Talk to me about doing this research from a home base in Kansas. Do you think that your research location has shaped your inquiry at all, your perspective, or no?
No, I started my research long time ago before I arrived in Kansas. So it wasn't the location where I am which shaped my research in general. And my interest is in international communication. So I've received a lot of support from my school for doing international research.
Let's talk to Slater in Overland Park. Slater's called 816-235-2888. Hi, Slater.
Hi. My question was, what other major countries, I guess, are basically in denial about climate change the same way that half of our country seems to be?
Okay, so the question then about the news would be where it's framed as a debate or framed as an issue of needing to prove that it's real.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, Hong.
Okay, so we didn't look at one specific country to give you a name, but the more developed countries in our sample include the UK, France, and those countries in Europe and North America, like Canada and the U.S.
And what are some of the less developed or less wealthy nations that you studied?
We look at a few countries from Africa, but we also look at countries from Asia as well. Like, for example, we look at Malaysia. We look at countries in South America as well, so like Peru and those countries that have Spanish as their official language.
Let's talk to Roland in St. Joseph, Missouri. Roland has a concern about perhaps why we get stuck at this stage of the conversation. Hi, Roland.
Hi. Yeah, I feel like we're not looking at the source of some of this stuff. If you got a product that hurts people or is polluting the atmosphere, then maybe look at the source of all these companies that are making millions and profiting from, you know, our climate change. I think the hard questions aren't being asked, and maybe looking at a history of suppression of throughout history globally, just companies, you know, taking advantage of people, or, you know, cigarettes are great, asbestos, it won't hurt you, but we come to find out these things are harmful to us.
Okay, so the role of economic interest in preventing a really candid conversation just about the science. And I'm going to put this one to John Upton.
Yeah, there's been a very narrow economic sector, but a very powerful one that profits and has profited from fossil fuel extraction and burning. And for decades, they've been investing very heavily. It's been, you know, revealed pretty adequately in recent years by some fantastic investigative journalism. They've really played a heavy role in publicly challenging the science and making, you know, using lobbyists and so forth to very successfully steer this away from being a conversation about science and a conversation about how will we be affected and a conversation about what should we do about it, and really shifting it towards this more kind of toxic conversation where you have for a long time had a lot of, you know, talking heads given equal airtime with scientists basically saying that, you know, the scientists are wrong, you know, they're corrupt, the science can't be trusted for this reason, that reason. And it's very easy to find a lot of these conspiracy theories on the internet, including actually in some news coverage. It sneaks in less and less now. But, you know, that all comes from an industry, and that's an industry that has known where to focus its political attention and its pressure, and that's in places like Australia, like the US, like the UK, the places that actually produce and use most of the fossil fuels. And when it comes to climate change, you're really the perpetrators of this global crisis, whereas the, you know, the less developed countries, they're more like the victims because they aren't kind of, they aren't putting up the same amount of pollution as what we are. So the caller is absolutely 100% right. A lot of this misinformation, a lot of the confusion has come from businesses that have an economic stake in continuing to drill oil and burn coal, as opposed to shifting to newer, cleaner, much more exciting alternatives that are, you know, high tech alternatives. We've been discouraged from moving away from by these old companies that are very powerful.
Would it be fair to maybe suggest that also the residents of those countries have comforts and habits that require fossil fuels to sustain them?
Of course, yeah. No, yeah. And like I say, you know, if you think of us as being the perpetrators, it's very difficult to have a conversation about harm that we're causing to people who are invisible to us. But at the same time, you know, we've been kind of fooled into believing that fixing climate change requires giving up a lot of our luxuries. And yes, we do need to make some changes. And, you know, obviously shifting away from beef in favor of other meats and vegetables is a big deal. Shifting away from oil and coal is a huge deal. But we can do, you know, we could be making this transition much less painfully if we'd started earlier and if we were more upfront and honest with ourselves about the fact that this is an exciting opportunity rather than something to be afraid of.
Let's talk to Rick in Independence. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. To summarize what's going on here, we become accustomed to a new normal of man-made crises, one after another, all of which are not manageable by our federal government. And this is not a climate crisis. It's a climate emergency. The evidence is in. If we don't act, there's only one alternative, and it's mass extinction of every species on planet Earth. Will be a dead planet. There will be no USA on a dead planet. So we have to act, and our federal government is not going to help us, at least not anytime in the immediate future.
Okay, Rick, I'm going to jump in and turn to our guests because I am curious, Hong. I mean, I know that you were looking at really specific things in your comparisons, but I also wonder if this sort of the sort of other poll, if you're looking at a polarized kind of coverage, the poll that is not denial might be very dramatic language. And not to say that Rick is inaccurate by any means, but I am curious if you see that same kind of language internationally.
Well, in developed countries, I have seen that the narrative in terms of talking about climate change is pretty similar across those countries, especially the one like we have mentioned, the UK, Canada, and Australia, France, for example. So what we have seen is that usually climate change, or the kind of discourse about climate change, is pretty similar.
John, when you hear Rick speaking, that seems, you know, part of his point is that the problem exceeds the capacity of just a federal government intervention. And I wonder if that to you is part of this same argument you're making about local journalism and its importance.
Well, I think that absolutely we could never just rely on the federal government to fix this for us. It's something that needs to be a lot of people, a lot of states, cities need to be excited about tackling this. And in fact, that's where you see a lot of the energy coming from when it comes to excitement around trying to tackle climate change and the urgency. It comes from the cities, it comes from the states. The, you know, the higher up you get in that government hierarchy, the less urgency you see. So there is a role, of course, for the federal government. There's a role for a state government. There's a role for local government. But there's also a role for corporations, individuals, consumers, the media. This is a huge problem. It's not going to be solved quickly or easily by any one entity. It really does require kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach.
What is your advice to American journalists? And I guess I want to frame that specifically through Rick's question, because I mentioned the dramatic language he used, and I don't mean dramatic, again, as in inaccurate. I am curious about how effective you think it is to talk about, I mean, we heard those news clips earlier in the show, the word dire again and again, how effective it is to sort of like sound the alarms that way.
Well, there's a constant debate around this, and it's kind of a painful debate because it really gets us nowhere. I think what's important is that journalists have to be honest. You know, we need to tell the truth, and there is an opportunity for this to not be dire. I mean, it will always. There's people being hurt by it right now. It's a tremendous injustice. The people who are hurt the most are those in the poorest countries and the poorest communities. But I mean, when it comes to language, just do what's right in your community. If climate change is a political term in your community, then stay away from it and use different words. But I would say that, you know, having a story that emphasizes that we're all completely ruined and we have no hope of fixing this and that we're just doomed, that's as inaccurate as the old way, which was to ignore climate change. So, yes, it is absolutely correct and accurate to describe what some of the future scenarios will be. It's accurate and necessary to describe what's happening right now, the tremendous suffering that's already occurring because of the heavy rainfall, because of these higher seas. But what you want to make sure is your story has balance, and the balance is not about science versus non-science. The balance is about figuring out what the current scenario is, what we're looking at in the future, what we can do to avoid the worst impacts.
Well,
and also how we can adapt to the changes that we're seeing.
John Upton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John is the Journalism Partnerships Editor for Climate Central, and Hong Vu with us from KU's William Allen White School of Journalism. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, American cheese. Are the orange slices individually wrapped in plastic a thing of the past? Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about cheese. Specifically, cheese made here in America, because our reputation for cheese has not been great historically, but that might be changing thanks to a new generation of cheese makers and cheese eaters. I noticed it in real life, but then it was confirmed in a BBC report I heard in my car last month. But let's hear what our local cheese experts think. Sarah Hoffman of Green Dirt Farm, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Lincoln Broadbooks of Better Cheddar, thanks for joining us from the Prairie Village store.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Do you agree, the two of you, with the BBC that everything the rest of the world thinks they know about American cheese is wrong, or at least changing?
Well, I guess I don't really know what the rest of the world thinks about American cheese, but I know what Americans often think about American cheese. And oftentimes we think of American cheese as American craft singles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in recent years that has really changed significantly.
Describe what's going on right now in American cheesemaking.
Well, we have many, many artisanal cheesemakers who've gone back to traditional means of producing cheese and are producing cheese with real flavor and honoring, very old traditions of cheesemaking and honoring the sense of terroir, which is flavor that comes from the land. And
so that would be like cheese in Wisconsin tastes different from cheese made in California.
Absolutely.
In theory.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Lincoln, is that what you're seeing as you look at what's coming into your store and what's out there, what's available to you?
Yeah, I think so. People's tastes, Americans' tastes are changing, and they are looking for that more traditional flavor and artisan small batch cheese. So it's definitely we're getting there. We're getting away from the Kraft singles for sure.
Sarah, give us a little history of that little Kraft single, the orange square with a predictable uniform taste wrapped in plastic.
Oh, sure. So, you know, to go way back, American cheese making started really as a tradition of commodity cheese. And cheese was made actually to ship to the Caribbean islands in exchange for rum. And cheese in the United States was made as a commodity to feed slaves in the Caribbean islands because cheese is a very nutritious product. It has very dense nutrition, and it's a good way to feed somebody in an efficient way. But that started our whole tradition of cheesemaking in the United States, and it just became our tradition of cheesemaking wasn't really a tradition. It was always a business commodity until maybe about the 1970s when people came back from traveling abroad and having had some of the fantastic traditional cheeses that were made in small villages over in Europe. And they came to the U.S. and they're like, why don't we have any of these cheeses here? And I, you know, I'm very fortunate in that I have an aunt who had a gourmet cheese shop in New Jersey in the late 70s. And she was a real groundbreaker in many ways. She was, you know, had a woman-owned business when that was very unusual, but also did, you know, was very interested in gourmet cheese, had traveled a lot in Europe and brought those European cheeses to the U.S. And I got to experience that through her. I got to learn about really fine cheese, really fine European cheeses through her. But at the time that she had her shop, there were no good, you know, fine artisanal American cheeses. And that has really changed because of some really enterprising and entrepreneurial people who said, why don't we have these really fine cheeses here in the United States? Let's do this.
People made the cheeses they wanted to eat.
Right, that's right.
But I want to say you're inspired by European cheese making. You aren't entirely replicating European cheese making. I know about this in some detail because I worked on your farm as a farmhand for a while, and we've talked at length about your story. But for our listeners who may not know, you don't work in an actual cave, for example.
No.
Nor could you in the United States.
No. We have we call it our cheese kitchen, and it's right next to our dairy parlor so that we can bring the milk. We also are buying milk from other small nearby farms that use the same farm practices that we have. Super important for us to be grass-based because that's where the flavor in the cheese comes from. And our little cheese kitchen is, you know, a very easy to clean little place that's built into the side of a hill on our farm. But it's not a cave like some cheese making used to be in the old days. But if you go to Europe and you see the artisanal cheese makers, you might see an alpine hut where they're making cheese. But for the most part, European cheese makers are making cheese in the same kinds of facilities that we are, not so much in caves anymore.
Yeah, and the kind of facility you're in, I mean, it feels like a lab. You know, you step in, you put on, like, it's almost like scrubs.
Yes, we call them our Oompa Loompa suits.
Yeah. And you step into, like, Crocs, uh-huh, and through a foot bath that takes off any, like, germs from
the
outside. It's a very carefully sanitary environment.
Yes. Well, food safety is super important in cheese making. And we know that 99.9% of the microorganisms in the world are actually helping us. But there's that 0.1% that we want to make sure stays outside of our cheese kitchen and that we only have the good guys. You know, we have a good microbiome inside our cheese kitchen. So we make sure that we're not bringing outside dirt and manure into the cheese kitchen by taking those kinds of measures that you talked about.
Yeah, because right outside the door is the farm.
That's right.
So, Lincoln, talk to me about your perspective as someone who gets cheese in from all over the country and from overseas. You have a pretty unique lens for understanding the role of American cheese in sort of like the global cheese world.
Yeah. Well, I think American cheese, what we do best in America as far as cheese making goes is we make new things. Not that our basic recipes are going to be, you know, European style recipes generally.
Cheese is not new.
Yeah. But you have this, entrepreneurial spirit in America, and we start to to play with those recipes and come up with things that not are necessarily new, but we build on European cheeses.
Give me an example of an American cheese that is building on a European tradition but doing something super entrepreneurial.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, Rogue River Blue just came out. It's 2019 batch just came out, and it's a seasonal cheese. It comes out on September 23rd every year. And what they're trying to do is instead of replicating a, you know, a European blue, they're trying to make an Oregon blue. And they're trying to get Oregon terroir into that cheese. So they're using their grass-fed Oregon cows, and they're using Oregon grape leaves, and they're soaking those grape leaves into a Clear Creek pear brandy.
Okay, well, we will be tasting some cheeses momentarily, but Sarah, this is pretty similar to the kind of philosophy you bring to what you do on Green Dirt Farm.
Sure. Well, we take a very unusual milk. It's a rare milk in Europe, but much beloved, and that's sheep's milk. And we make a variety of different cheeses, most of which are inspired by some European cheese, but is a whole new recipe that we developed on the farm. And so we take great pride in that. And it's a lot of fun, a very creative process to figure out a whole new cheese. And we've made a bunch of different cheeses using sheep milk to create something that's similar to a European cheese, but is really quite unique in that it's made with sheep's milk. And because of the whole sense of terroir and the milk coming from our farm and our nearby farms only tastes like that here, right here.
You know, when you talk about creating a new cheese, I just want to say, when you're trying a new recipe for cupcakes, you put them in the oven and then, you know, it's not too long before you taste and see if that worked. With cheese, it's not even overnight. I mean, you're talking about an experiment that lasts a while.
Sure. Some of our cheeses age for at least 2 months before we ever even get to taste them or see what the final product is going to be like. Some of our cheeses age for 6 months before we know what the final flavor in the cheese is going to be like. But it does take a long time and a lot of trial and error, and a lot of cheese goes to the pigs.
So this is... we're going to taste some cheese. And when I say we, I mean my producer, Melody. She's going to do it so I can keep talking to you while the sampling is taking place. Melody Rowell, thank you for being our official cheese taster.
I have been training my whole life for this. I'm ready.
Please note, I will be trying them myself when we're off the air. But okay, Sarah brought some things from Green Dirt Farm. We'll start with those because we've just been hearing a little bit about them. And then we'll hear about some of the other American cheeses Lincoln recommends trying this fall. Sarah, what have you brought Melody to try?
So what Melody's about to try is our most popular aged cheese. That's our cheese that we call Dirt Lover.
I love
and
that one.
We call it Dirt Lover because, we know that everything that we do on the farm starts from the foundation of our soil, and taking really good care of our soil and loving our soil is really important to us. But we also call it Dirt Lover because... So we're all dirt lovers at Green Dirt Farm, but we also call it Dirt Lover because it's a cheese that's been coated with a layer of vegetable ash to help develop just the right kind of rind, get that rind to grow in just the way we want it to.
So it looks like dirt, but it is not dirt.
Yes, it's not dirt. It is vegetable ash.
Melody, what do you think?
It's very creamy. It's kind of mild in flavor. Mm-hmm. Reminds me of like a gentler brie.
Lemony, and get a little butter and lemony flavors.
Yes,
maybe a bit of mushroom on the aftertaste there.
Oh yeah, I do taste that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna try the next piece without a cracker, so I don't corrupt the flavor.
So yeah, what else did you bring, Sarah?
So we have our Tuffet, which is a lovely yeast-rinded cheese, and the yeast gives it that beautiful wrinkly rind. We just love this cheese. It was developed by our cheesemaker, Rachel Klein, in homage to Latour, which is a yeast-rinded cheese made generally with cow's milk. But this one is made with 100% sheep's milk, and we just love it. It's like eating cheesecake when you eat it. It's light and fluffy. And
Yeah, the texture is a little bit almost like ricotta, where it's a smooth chunk. It's not an eloquent way to put that.
No, it's quite eloquent.
But then it finishes with almost like a honey kind
honey
of
note. Nectar.
Yeah.
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 Okay, that sounds really good. So these are from right around here, a farm in Weston, Missouri, Green Dirt Farm. Lincoln from Better Cheddar has brought in, Sarah, if you wouldn't mind passing those over to Melody. Lincoln, what did you bring when you're thinking about American cheeses to recommend this fall?
Yeah, so, excuse me. I went really Missouri here.
Yay!
There are a couple things that aren't, but that first thing that you're trying there, that is actually Green Dirt Farm's fresh sheep's milk cheese. But for the fall, I put a little bit of a maruba on it, which is basically a Middle Eastern, Central Asia kind of spiced fruit jam. And it just kicks up the fall.
And I want to just say, fresh cheese, that means it has not aged.
Exactly. It's soft and spreadable. It's kind of like Chev, the goat cheese Chev, but it doesn't have the same flavors that Chev has at all.
So you're really tasting sheep's milk.
Yes.
I really feel like I just ate a piece or a slice of cheesecake with some kind of like fruit crumble on top. That's incredible.
That's actually pumpkin, and they put a little bit of almonds in it and some spices. So
pumpkin spices.
Yeah, pretty much. They are warm spices. Yeah, so if you go that, you may not be able to taste anything else.
Okay.
But you can.
Let's try a milder one.
Okay. So that right there is called Grissenthaler.
It's got holes in it.
It has holes, so it is a Swiss-style cheese. This is from Ava, Missouri, and Grissen Creamery makes this cheese. And this is an aged Swiss-style cheese. Or Alpine style cheese. It's got the holes. It's got that Swiss flavor. And it has a sweetness to it as well. So it's nutty and sweet. And this is cow's milk. He actually is a Swiss immigrant. When he was young, his parents brought him to Ava, Missouri. And then he went back, the cheesemaker did, went back to Switzerland when he was 20 to learn Alpine cheese making.
Truly the dream.
And so, we have some pretty good Alpine style cheeses being made in Missouri. Well, and even Green Dirt Farm, your Ozark is really, really good Alpine style cheese. So, yeah.
Yeah, that one was not too strong.
Yeah.
But I could definitely eat a whole block of that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Does that seem like good grilled cheese material?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You could definitely do that. I picked these. There's a couple there that are from Grissen Farm, but because they melt really well and for the fall, you know, doing fondues and melting cheeses and things like that. So that right there that you just tasted is a cheese that it's actually our best-selling cheese now. We call it 48th Street Reserve. We get young, couple-day-old 40-pound blocks from Hemi Brothers in Sweet Springs, Missouri, and then we age them in our own little aging room on the plaza. And that's aged for about a year, and it's just a full-flavored cheddar, not too sharp, but it's got some other interesting flavors going on. And
it reminds me a little bit like if Gouda and cheddar had a baby, it would be this cheese.
Yeah. So it does have some sweetness. In the Midwest, we've started to really like those cheddars that have a little bit of sweetness on the finish. And I think that's where you're getting the Gouda from. Definitely.
Lincoln.
Yeah.
Now is a good time to have Melody try the cheese that she won't be able to taste anything afterwards.
Gotcha.
Let me just describe it real quick.
Yeah,
it's on a toothpick. It is kind of a big crumble, and it has
very irregular shape.
Yes.
Rustic. And it's
rustic,
and it's got green blue woven throughout. So I take it this is some kind of blue cheese.
It is a blue cheese. And actually, I mentioned it earlier.
Talk about it, Lincoln.
Yeah, this is Rogue River Blue. Like I said, seasonal, really flavorful. You can taste the pear brandy that they soak the leaves that they wrap the cheese in. It's just really, really nice. It reminds me of just a really nice blue cheese with some alcohol on the outside of it. Yeah.
What more could you want from a cheese, really?
Exactly.
And it's not it's not too strong. It doesn't tickle your throat. really satisfying.
Yeah, really creamy too.
Yeah.
Yeah, super creamy.
Thank God our time is up because I'm hungry from cheese. Lincoln Broadbooks of The Better Cheddar, Sarah Hoffman of Green Dirt Farm, thanks so much for this American cheese tutorial.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Melody Rowell, producer of Central Standard, thank you for your service.
It's truly my pleasure.
We are headed out, but you can grab both of this morning's conversations later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. We spoke earlier about how the media covers climate change in the U.S. and beyond. There is a difference, and it's fascinating. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, why we should value humor in romantic relationships. It's based on actual research, so listen up. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Noah Taborda, Ann Knigendorf, and Aviva Oketson-Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.